the Forged and Unbroken podcast.
Well, dude, thanks for hanging out. It's I missed you guys down in Carolina. How did that go?
It went well. Again, another awesome event. Had a good time. A lot of new speakers, first time speakers that we haven't heard before, which made it nice. And yeah, cool. A lot of great, you know, just the energy down there. The experience is just, it was another good year. I think this was more powerful year than last year. So it was pretty good.
Oh, hell yeah. Yeah, I definitely missed you guys. Like seeing the pictures, I definitely had a little bit of FOMO.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, I totally get it.
When I went down there, I was down there a couple years ago for a concert. First time I'd actually been in Charlottesville proper. And it was cool just to see. One, I love the area just because you got Shenandoah like right in the back door. So there's tons of great hiking. And then you just have like this historic city meets college town meets like a little bit of mountain town vibe. Like there's a lot of going on in a small space. So if you could like just give us the rundown of what Charlottesville is and just some of the uniqueness that you guys have in town.
Absolutely. So one of the things to start off with, Charlottesville's 10 square miles. Well, just under 10 square miles, but we're a big city, tight, packed into a little town, little city vibes. Having the historic downtown area as well as the college that's there that's been around since, I want to say 1800. Caught me off guard for that one, but it was around the 1800s. It came around, but with the history that you have back there of Thomas Jefferson and all the the coming of the United States and its, you know, the birth of it, all that still is there, which is still kind of crazy to think about. And people come from all over to see that. And really we miss out and don't really know what we have until somebody comes in and says, wow, you guys really work in Charlottesville. And you're like, well, yeah, you know, think about the historic significance of that city that we're at. So it's kind of cool. As far as the area, yeah, if you are bored and run out of things to do, you've not done everything that's possible. Like it's, you're lying or you're just not into hiking or outdoor stuff. The city itself has a trail that goes around the city, the Rivanna Trail, which is pretty cool. You could bike, hike, walk, run. They have all different types of stuff that goes on that trail. And then you go into the Shenandoah National Forest and George Washington National Park, with all the trails, the Appalachian trails at the back door, the Blue Ridge Parkway, the Skyline Drive is right there, the access for both of them, north and south. So it's kind of a neat area to be in. And then you go, you know, 5 or 10 miles outside of the city and you're in a completely rural area that where our wineries and breweries are. And that's a whole nother vibe of the environment that's around. So it's kind of a neat area. If you want city stuff, you go downtown. If you don't want city stuff, 5 miles, a short drive outside of the city, you're in a rural area that no one's around you. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a really deep mix. And it's all right there, just like in a condensed location, right? You get a little bit of everything, small package.
Yeah.
What are some of the unique challenges? So, where I'm at, we're in the back door of DC, but also Baltimore City, where I live at in Frederick. Pre-Civil War town, same thing with where I'm at in Ellicott City. A lot of buildings date back to, you know, Civil War era on up. And there's even history that runs deeper than that. And that presents just tactical challenges when we get out on these calls. So what are some of the things that most people wouldn't even consider that you're dealing with just in your area?
Yeah, so construction, because we're 10 square miles, we're kind of landlocked as far as the city goes. So they've just recently passed the ordinance. Now we're growing up. Everything that is coming in now is going 10 stories or above. So as far as tactically goes, we've got to switch our mindset from kind of a mid-rise area where we were like 8 stories was kind of our highest building to now. I think that one of the buildings coming in is going to be 19 stories, which is going to be a block down from the firehouse. Wow. So we have that modern construction that's coming in, and then we're looking at that, and then we'll run a fire alarm there. And then 2 minutes later, we'll run down to the college where we've got large mansions that have been cut up into fraternity or sorority houses that are housing 18, 20 people at a time in loft style beds. And they're sleeping 4 or 5 in these rooms, but you can take a 6-foot hook and slide underneath the loft style bed and never hit anything above your head. So tactically understanding kind of the layout of the houses and how things are how to sleep or live in these, for lack of better terms, these single room occupancies, is kind of something we encounter a lot. And we're not only seeing that on campus, we're seeing it throughout the city in older areas with the larger houses where people are coming in and cutting the houses up into 4, 6, 8 apartments sometimes and packing families in there. And that's, I mean, we're not unique to that. Everywhere's having that, but it's not unique to us, but it's newer to us than because we're a newer department. Within the last 8 years, we went from a pretty senior department to, I think the average now is like 5.5 or 6 years on the job total in our department. So we're finding all these challenges again that have always been there. They're just now being revisited again with the new generation of firefighter that we're employing. And it's good for the older guys that are there to kind of revisit all that, where kind of, like I said, revisiting and looking at the new tactics and everything and modern technologies as far as the firefight itself, and passing that information on to the newer generation, because they're going to be here long after we're gone. And so is the city.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. How many years do you have on now?
This is my 17th year in Charlottesville, and I was somewhere prior to this 11 years. So 18 years paid and right at 30 couple years on the fire service with a volunteer.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's a good run, man.
Yeah.
We have something pretty similar with our area, where you take these historic towns and you know, like a lot of what was going on during that time, you have the mills, right, or in general stores, and then they get turned over into mechanic shops. You know, the horse stables are going to mechanic shops, and then all of a sudden it becomes a cafe and then a yoga studio, and now it's the one manor in town is now split up into 8 different apartments, you know. So it's, you got so many different years of or decades and generations of construction with construction styles, different codes or lack of codes. You got to be Johnny on the spot. Like there's so many things that you can get hit with that you would never consider. And the thing that I think is pretty funny is there's a saying, you don't build them like you used to. You had poor craftsmen back in the day too. Like the human dynamic is always going to be what it is. So sometimes on these calls, man, you just don't know what you're going to get into.
Oh no, not at all. I mean, we were in a building a month or so ago, and it came in with an old business name, and we knew it wasn't that anymore, but we go in and they've completely gutted it completely. It was an old type 3 construction work, the heavy timber and masonry walls and everything. And then you couldn't tell it was an old building. It was all modernized inside. It looked like a high end restaurant in there. And it's like, what are we doing? And we literally pulled the walls down, and there was the old building. It was kind of crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. We have all the exact same things going on. It's also sometimes with the newer buildings coming in, they're making them look like the 1800s buildings as well. Yeah. And they're not. So it's an interesting mix. You said something
there. You have this conversations like building construction, where you talk to the newer guys and you talk about the King's Row, the Soldier's Row, and they're like, well, this building they put up, you know, a year ago has that same thing. Like, that's different. It looks the same. Like, it looks the same, but it's different. It's kind of those odd conversations we have to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Little things you pick up on. Mentioned something about like the generational differences and on and whatnot. To get into that though, you have your hands in just a lot of different training circles. So if you could, what's your current position? But then I know you've been involved with training within your own department, phase, but then also FDI. You've had your hands in all kinds of really cool stuff. So like, give us the rundown of some of the things you've been involved with and the good work that you put out.
I'm fortunate enough to be associated with several good training companies out there. I unfortunately haven't made it to FDIC yet. I've tried for several years and just been, haven't got the nod yet, but that I'm still going to try. It's kind of cool that I feel obligated, you know, not obligated, but I feel privileged that I could even suggest to do that. But the several other training companies I'm involved with, for example, the 350 line, we push out engine company operations. They do a good job with kind of taking the nozzle forward stuff and making it practical for your department. They'll come in a couple of days ahead of time, look at your department and kind of build out a system for you and your department that way. And that's excellent to do. Some of the other stuff I get associated with, I get to go out to Wichita Hot. They do an excellent job out there seeing the country, seeing the Midwest is kind of cool. They do stuff a lot different out there as far as schedules and apparatus setup and stuff like that. It's kind of neat to see. And then locally, we just hang out here in the state with a couple different organizations from the Smithfield Truck School, Bedford Truck School, and then more recently, I'm going back to Charlottesville now that the schedule works out to help with their truck school. And it's bringing the basics back and taking the basics and making them where you don't mess those up, and then just showing you how far advanced you can get with just basic stuff. Nothing new, nothing outside the box type thinking. It's all just basic movements, basic techniques for forcible entry, laddering abilities, opening up roofs, can work, building instruction, stuff like that. And then locally, in my department, I was associated with the training division for a few years and helped turn out 6 recruit classes, which is still a lot of them are still employed at Charlottesville. And then currently I'm just a captain on the ladder truck that's downtown for right now. So we'll see where that takes me in the next couple months.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, you and me both, man. Captain on a ladder truck. It's pretty good living.
It's a good time. The crew I have right now is pretty awesome. We got them released to operate the ladder, the front of the ladder, and then also the till. So that's all officially done. The paperwork set in place. Now it's been that's been a fun few months learning with them all over again, ladder truck, because we have a tractor drawn. So picking up stuff that I either forgot about or didn't even know about because this day and age with technology, the operator really delves into like finding out the root of a lot of information that we look for. So it's kind of cool to see him do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. We're in a similar boat. We are also on a tractor drawn, and our unit's a 2012 now. And we're now, I think, on year 3 of waiting for our new one to come in, and it keeps getting pushed back. It's getting pushed back. And now it's not even looking like until early 2007 now. So, but yeah, neither here nor there. It's like, I love that the strategy and tactics behind truck work. I've always had an interest in it, and I've been assigned to this truck as a firefighter. So it's been awesome to come back and do the officer side of it and get people trained up. And I'm learning just as much as them, just getting back in the swing of things, being on engine companies the last few years as well. Yeah. It's good living though.
Yeah. I agree. I like the aspect of it, of kind of the thinking. It's a thinking man's game when you're on the ladder truck, because you always have to kind of stay a few steps ahead, I feel, of the engine officer, and kind of like being the same level battalion chief to kind of push things forward, like the fire's going this way or that way, or the building's doing this, or we should try this, we're trying to get in, or whatever it may be, some tech rescue or something like that. But that's kind of a cool part of the fire service. I really enjoyed being that thinking man's game of trying to manipulate the fire scene the best we can for a better outcome.
Yeah, I like the way you put that. We also have on ours, we are set up similar to rescue squads also. So we're also uses extrication pieces. Do you all have similar setups?
Yeah, same thing. So both our ladder trucks are set up with all the extrication pieces, any type of collapse stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Some confined space stuff we can do up to a certain point. So it's, yeah, we're pretty much set up to be self-sufficient on the fire scene.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Somewhat. Similar. So with all the different, you know, places you find yourself around the country and with the different roles that you have in training, you know, 30 years, you get to see a lot of things, right? There are definitely some things in the fire service in my just over 20 years now that have changed. Like, yeah, we definitely don't do that anymore. Like, this is a shift in mindset to where compared to when I came in. And there are other things where, like, now the more things have changed, they've stayed the same. If you could think of your top couple things that, as far as, let's say, like the holes in the fire service, like when you're going out training and you're getting to talk to people, meet people, you're rubbing elbows from East Coast to Midwest, if there are holes that you can identify that seem to be common themes of, like, hey, this is generally where people really need to lean in on? Like, what would you say those things are?
Oh, well, that's a great question. Yeah, as much as the five, over the 30 years, you kind of look back and we, for some odd reason, over the last few months, we've been getting into that conversation at work of like what it was like 10 years ago, what it was like 15 years ago versus what it's like now.
Yeah, sure.
It's kind of the same theme that keeps going on, you know, failures and upper management doesn't communicate enough. We've had that conversation since I first started. Like they've never communicated back then and they don't communicate now. That's what we always hear, which is kind of funny to see. It's like, and you look back and you're like, wow, actually they did communicate. It was just done in different forms. When I first started, there was a memo board. So every day the captain would sit down with you and you'd have a memo board per shift and everybody had to jot their name down after you read the memo. Like it would go around the morning meeting table and you read the memo and your initials were on it. So they'd be like, oh, you read the memo. Remember this one, Richard? You never really read the memo. You're like, all right, whatever. Then it went to like emails. So an email would come out and everybody would sign an email. And now it's target solutions or some online record management system, whatever you may use, that we use that rolls out. And it's just kind of crazy to see that the communication aspect, everybody complains about it now and they complained about it back then. And even talking to my dad and everybody else that was the older firefighters, they're like, well, yeah, they never talked to us. We're like, what do you mean? Like, same. It's crazy how that still is an issue in the fire service as far as like those type of, if that's what you're considering a type of hole that's still in the fire service, that's kind of generational, no matter when it was. I'm sure if we if we were able to go back in time and look then, and they probably complained about, you know, the messengers never getting the stuff to the firehouse in time or something like that. Right.
Right.
So, but the communication thing's a big one. Even though we have the technology and the power to communicate in the palm of our hand all the time, we still have a communication issue in the fire service, which is still kind of crazy. And then we take that communication, sometimes it's in the palm of our hand, and send an email out or send a text message out or a group text, and you may read it or interpret the group text or email differently than I may because of a word that's in there. And then you're getting not necessarily different views, but different aspects of the same conversation. And you're like, well, that's not really what he said, but let's talk about it. And then you've got to adjust it a little differently for everybody differently. Cause then you look at it and you're like, wow, I've never thought of it that way, where we could all read the same book and you interpret the book a little differently than I do. And then, you know, looking at it that way, it's kind of odd as an officer to see that type of communication issue that we have. What else? Just the way things are done in the firehouse in general, you know, the firefighters aren't different per se year to year for generational stuff. They're just new people. You know, when I first came in, you had to have people had some kind of background as far as doing something with their hands, their HVAC, construction, plumbers. They went to a trade school or they were in tech school when they were in high school or whatever, that you don't see that anymore. We're actually having, I know in a couple fire academies in our area, they're actually having one day a week, they're having like a tool day that they literally pull tools out and learn how to use them. Everything from a screwdriver to a chainsaw. Because, you know, and honestly, there's not too many people that know how to mow grass. We Saturdays are our yard days. And you could tell people that have like done yard work their whole life versus somebody that looks at you and goes, man, I never operated one of these. And I'm like, it's just a leaf blower. You point the open end out. He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. So, but we're getting that, like with all different types of life experience, you know. I mentioned in my senior man lecture, one of the guys never knew how to cook because his parents did it for him. And then you find out about their life experience and he didn't need to cook. His parents did it for him his whole life. And he was 19 years old coming to a firehouse. So you look at that and you're like, all right, so we actually need to teach him blue collar stuff all the way to mowing grass from cooking, right?
Yeah.
Anything basic to the high end stuff. So those are some of the holes that I see frequently and hear senior guys talk about, officers and senior around the firehouse talk about that they're struggling with now. It's like, geez, you don't know how to operate a whatever, a Flugelbinder. You know, well, let me show you how to do it, right? I don't know. So
I want to dig in on that really quick. With you being a captain in a firehouse, one thing I've noticed is absolutely, I have people that will just come to me and say, listen, I am not mechanically inclined. I don't know how to do this, which I appreciate the honesty, and I don't hold that against that person. So there are definitely barriers there. On the flip side, though, one thing that me and some of my other friends that are in the officer ranks have noticed is that as long as you explain the why really well, they're much more likely to buy in. And they might be asking why. They might be asking all kinds of questions. And for some people in the older generation, like, you know, it was more of a do as I say, not as I do. Like that was certainly the way it was when I came in, or just, you know, just do it, just go, make it go away. But as long as you give them the why, the buy-in goes through the roof, and then they're like one of your greatest support networks. How do you manage that from your side? And what are some of those cultural things that you're seeing? Like, is that similar? Are you seeing that?
Yeah. Yeah, and that was one of the harder obstacles I had to cross over, was understanding that people need to know the why. And it wasn't that same generation I grew up in of like, well, it's, we forced this door because I said so. Well, why are we forcing the door? Well, it's locked. Oh, well, that makes sense. I mean, it's something that simple, right? But you look at it, but your why could be as simple or as dumb as the sun's up today. Oh, okay. I mean, they don't really, they honestly sometimes don't care what the why is. They just want to know why we're doing it.
Yeah.
So once I got over that obstacle of like, hey, just explain to the why every single time, my success rate went up tenfold for getting stuff done and getting buy-in on the firehouse floor of whatever I need to do. Are they going to bitch and complain after doing it or because of it? Absolutely. They're firemen. They're allowed to bitch and complain all they want. I mean, that's their job. That's our job. And as officers, that's our job to push them to push them through the event, even though they're bitching and complaining.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what I found is like, once they know the why, and again, the why could be, it's just as simple as because it's daylight. And like, yeah, all right, that's horseshit, but I guess I'll go do it. And they'll do it.
Yeah.
Right. And they'll do it. Like, yeah. And that's what I found that a lot of people just want, like, just as simple, even management. Like, they'll send something down and the guy's like, why are we doing this? I'm like, I don't know, but I'll find out. And the manager's like, well, budget's tighter, whatever. Okay. Just tell us the why. And overall, shift wise, it's easier to digest a little bit. You don't have to agree with it at all, but at least you know what the why is. And, you know, you could then pass that on, and then even giving them the why, they could open up to other suggestions of, well, what about this, or what about this idea? What about this idea? And it opens up a great dialogue amongst your shift and amongst your people.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes they'll ask the why and ask specific questions. And then it forces me to be a little bit more reflective and be like, okay, can I defend this, or am I just regurgitating something that somebody else told me? Right. So then you either get even more buy-in, or they, not that they rock you back on your heels intentionally, like they're not trying to be an antagonist, but it's like, no, you're actually making me think a little bit deeper than this. So now I got to have some good answers for you when I come back.
Yeah. And one of my biggest weapons is I don't know. I may not know the answer, but me being upfront and honest and saying, I don't know, or I don't have an answer for you, or let me go ask and come back with, hey, they're not telling me anything. That's definitely something that has been a great weapon for me. And I use weapon lightly, but the simple term of I don't know.
Yeah.
But let's try to figure it out together. That's given me a lot of buy-in that way too. Cause they see that I'm not perfect. You know, I have captain's bars and that's about it. They promoted me because I was the last one on the list. I think, I'm not sure why they had to do a new list. Well, we better promote him before he files a grievance or something. Like
right.
That.
Lay at bottom of the barrel before we get to the next one.
Yeah. Right.
When you're now switch, like we hit communications and kind of mindset stuff, when we're switching to actual on the floor, whether it's in the engine bay or you are out at Wichita Hot or somewhere in the region, How have you had to adjust actual training?
Yeah.
Like actual hands-on stuff. How has that evolved over the years?
So it's been kind of interesting. I was helping out with and I didn't realize this. It kind of took a little self-reflection, but I went to a help a recruit academy last year. I think it was a few months ago, their last recruit academy in the county I live in. They asked me to come by and help for a day. And what they were looking for was this hardcore yelling instructor that I used to be, because it was more paramilitary. It's kind of hard. It's kind of, I don't like that word, but more militarized type thing. The instructor that led that, and I was one of his assistants, and that's what he wanted. And this instructor recently was just like, hey, I need that. And I'm like, well, there's other ways to do that now because people obtain information differently than they had in the past. And all because of the stuff we talked about, the why, the reasoning and stuff like that. And then when we're out doing training, whether it be locally or on the road, wherever I may be, you don't have really time to get people's backgrounds because you're only dealing with them for 4 hours, 8 hours, 16 hours type thing. But you've got to kind of adjust things on the fly based on what they're doing because of everything we've talked about so far. We don't know their background. They may not be mechanically inclined, and they may not have an understanding of what's going on, but they are told by their captain or their senior firefighter, hey, you should go to this class. It's pretty good. I went to it. I'm going, or tag along with me or something like that. And they could just be there because being forced to tag along to the class, and they're not having a clue. So if we're doing like a live fire can scenario or live fire forcible entry, this may be the first time they've seen a fire since academy, or a fire that hot because of a class B building they were taught in. We don't know all that. So we have to adjust to that. So we're like, all right, we've never seen a fire big, so let's gear the fire back a little bit. Let's just start working on the basics and kind of back up and punt. And based off that, we've kind of adjusted the group I teach with some of the live fire forcible entry and can stuff that we do out in Wichita or wherever I may be. We now have kind of slowed things down a little bit and made we used to do an 8-hour class that only goes 6 hours because of just repetitions and stuff, and people got tired. But we would slow things down to, now we're doing 4 hours of building the foundation, and then 4 hours of your crawl, walk, run, and then 4 hours of kind of running, sprinting type thing. Or 6 hours because you're all new to the fire service, and 2 hours of sprinting and running. And we've built that up to where we have that leverage to go either direction. That it's like a slide gauge, or lack of better terms, on how we're going to start. You know, I had the privilege of teaching in Fort Lauderdale for the Fort Lauderdale Fire Expo, which opened my eyes to a lot of stuff. And how that was there mainly, I didn't know this until I got down there, was that there was a lot of EMS based fire systems. So they primarily just rode on an ambulance, and the fire truck just sat in the bay because of new construction and how fast the communities are growing there. You know, they're not fighting fires a lot of the times out in the newer neighborhoods, but they're running a lot of medical calls. So understanding that they came in a medical system, and now they're kind of like, hey, you got a fire truck in your building now. So if that horn goes off, you need to take that one instead of the ambulance with the cot in it. And wow, it was eye-opening to see those people, to talk to them, and to be like, hey, man, we just carry EMS bags. Our EMS physical agility test was, I had to carry these two EMS bags up and down the stairs, two flights of stairs, 20 times. I'm like, that's it? And he goes, oh, no, I had to do like medical stuff too, but my physical part was like carrying these two EMS bags, two flights of stairs, 20 times. I was like,
wow.
So that's where we're starting. So kind of understand it, and you have to learn how to get that quick life experience from people as you're getting things set up. Mm-hmm. And with that comes the experience of like seeing, like there's like, you're always going to have the cocky, arrogant, boisterous firefighter that's on the fire scene. He's going to have a group of three or four people with him. Then you'll have the quiet ones that you can kind of see are skittish and really nervous about things, and just how people act. And you got to learn how to read people a lot with that. And then based on that, you just start talking to them. And at the end of the day, we're all human. So we all have different life experiences where we came from. And this is one of the things, you just have to just start talking. And you're like, wow, you're kind of, how old are you? I mean, if you look young, you probably are. How old are you? Well, I'm 19. Well, where'd you come from? Well, I came from, you know, wherever, North Dakota. Oh, okay, cool. I'm a volunteer, but I'm trying to get in the paid system. Oh, cool. How many calls y'all run? We were in 19 last year. Oh, cool. 19 a month? No, 19. Okay. So that's all year. He goes, yeah. He said, and they'll admit, we don't have a lot of experience. So I need shown A to Z real quick. All right. Well, that's what we do. And you just have that, you just kind of gauge it and find instructors that understand that is hard to do anymore. Because again, you know yourself, we're getting older. So trying to breed, trying to bring up and breed a good instructor from the younger group is hard to find with that because, we're all going to be gone. I'm on the back leg of my 18-hole golf course.
Yeah,
So
right.
I'm looking on my way out. So trying to find that to breed into new instructors that understand that because it's going to continue once we leave and retire.
Yeah, sure. I really appreciate the flexibility that you all are instilling. It kind of reminded me of that Abraham Lincoln quote where it's you give me 3 hours to cut down a tree, the first two I'm gonna sharpen my axe. Like you're putting up front end work, right? And you're adjusting to meet the students' needs. I think all too often, and especially, and I know we're guilty, we use the word paramilitary, and I think we've kind of softened that approach a little bit in our academies, at least. But even when you get in the field, like post academy settings, sometimes we try to fit our class or whatever our goals are for the day into whatever we think it needs to be. But as soon as we realize, like, okay, I need to pivot, like either they're not getting it or my delivery is piss poor or whatever it is, to be able to take a group of people and adjust on the fly like that and then meet the needs of the department or whatever the training group is or just even your shift, I think is kind of monumental nowadays. And that's an area where whether you're an instructor, the senior guy or gal, or the officer, whatever the case may be, like we could totally lean in on that more. And I think we're going to be a lot more successful for the fire service. 'Cause I'm with you, man. Like actually tonight we're having my class's 20-year party, like reunion party, 'cause we just hit
Oh, wow.
retirement age, So it's wild that we're on that backside now. I used to be the young snot-nosed kid, and now people are actually looking at me to make decisions.
It's kind of crazy to think that you'd sit around the table and you, I mean you sat in my lecture I talk about it. I was like, oh, I sit around the table, next thing I know, I was the senior guy, not only in tenure, but in the department. And it hit me like that. And I was like, holy crap, like it goes that fast. And people say like I'm eligible for retirement. Full retirement in 7.5 years, and they're like, the 7.5 years are gonna go by quick. I was like, there's no way. And I look, I'm like, wait a second, I just had 20 years go by like a blink of an eye. So yeah, but that's one thing that I've been struggling with older with the management on both battalion chiefs and deputy chiefs and stuff in our department, and they have a goal for the day, like we need to do whatever. And some days it's like, well, to get whatever, we've got to train this and this. And some days it's just not clicking for some people, and you have to back up and look at it and be like, hey, wait a second. The reason we didn't get to your goal today is because we had to teach them how to have a good foundation before we can go. Because I'm not going to be, I feel bad for people now that, yeah, they reached a goal. You were able to cross the finish line, but how did you cross that finish line? Were you crawling across or sliding across on your belly, or were you actually strutting across, like the cock diesel you should be, which is that's what my goal. And it's a lot of headbutting sometimes with senior leadership in our department and some places elsewhere. If you do incumbent training or something, that they're like, well, we expect them to be here. Well, if you didn't set that goal or tell them that why back then, don't expect your goal to be met until you figure that out.
So I guess let's have those two worlds meet up a little bit of the senior man stuff with what we just discussed. And I'll set it up with this. Actually, I think I mentioned this with one of the things I did in Carolina when we were down there together was there's a pretty cool report and study. It was like 3,500 data points where they took the groups of people that got injured over a course of period from major like suburban departments, right? And what they found was they broke it down into kind of 5-year groups, and they found out the reasons that they were getting injured. And the top two were like human error, lack of situational awareness, things like that. And the other one was lack of physical wellness. The thing that really stuck out to me though was the person most likely to get injured, and all of the, yes, it can be an injury laden profession that we find ourselves in. But the thing that stuck out to me was that like 15-year firefighter was the one who was most likely to get injured because of lack of situational awareness or human error. Now, I know I have kind of my experiences and opinions on that, but I'm going to push this to you. Like, yes, you're the company officer. You've been the senior man. Now you're the company officer with time under your belt, but you can't do everything. We need to lean on these senior people. And oftentimes it's you get one of two. You get the rock star that you can lean on, the backbone of their shift. But then other times you have the other person who, yeah, you're 15 to 20 years in. I need to lean on you. I want to lean on you. People want you to be that leader, but they're just lackluster. Like, and you can't get anything out of them. How do you create that relationship? How do you nurture it? How do you hold them accountable? Like, what's the give and take? Like, how do you operate between you and your senior person, or how do you build that?
That's a great question, because I struggle with that on a daily basis, because holding people accountable is a big thing for me. But what I find myself doing is just giving them small tasks. Can you take the trash out? All right, you did that. Hey, like the other day we were doing testing for the operator at Tillerman spot. And I looked at the senior guy was actually with me. So I looked at the next senior guy. I was like, hey, our cleaning chores need to be done. Can you get that accomplished? We came back from testing. Everything was taken care of. We needed a cook. There was a cook already ready. So building those small building blocks of accountability is where I find it best to learn how people are going to act. Not giving them a whole big, hey, I need you to do this, like five tasks in a row, because something's evidently going to be missed, right? But those small tasks of like clean assignments, like we need to find a cook for a day, just point somebody out, make sure the firehouse stays clean and everything's kept up until we're done. You know, small stuff that they can do that they feel like they're accomplishing something. But in the long run, you're looking at, all right, well, they're accountable for the small things. Now let's start handing them bigger things to look at and start doing. Hey, I need you to lead this or start leading this type of training every day or every third day or wherever it may be. And then once you get those small things, the medium things can happen. And once the medium things, small things, and medium things are getting done, and that accountability starts going up. Now, are people going to falter and fail sometimes? Absolutely. You just have to count on that. But it's a simple reminder, like, hey man, don't forget, we've got to do this, this, and this. And that's been the most difficult thing for me to do, because listening to you talk and interacting with you and conversations and things like that, I know our personalities are pretty similar. Like if I want something done, I'm just going to do it myself, because it's a lot easier to do it myself and spend the time to do it, because I know it's going to be done properly in my eyes. But if I have someone else do it, I'm going to have to probably go back and fix it most likely. That's been one of the harder things to do, to kind of release and relying on that senior man to do that. But by starting the small with small tasks and building those tasks up, you start developing the senior man in that aspect and that trust inside the firehouse. Now, outside the firehouse, like talk about situational awareness stuff. After one of your lectures, I was jotting some notes down, and I found myself that I was missing things because of that. I have time, like you could kind of read smoke really quick. You kind of miss, but I was starting to miss the small things on calls. And what I started doing was I got really good at like coming off the apparatus with my gloves on my hand, ready to go to work. What I started doing after one of your lectures, and I took some notes, and I can't remember the statement you made, but it was based around that 15-year firefighter that had the situational awareness was decreased. I started keeping one glove off. So it made me slow down for a second and look around and put that one glove on, which takes a few seconds. But those few seconds then looked at it, and I was able to slow things down, and I'm able to start noticing. I've been noticing things a little bit more and a little bit differently now that I'm taking this 3-ish seconds to put my glove on to go to work, even though I'm not masking up or I'm masking up or whatever. But that 3 or 5 seconds that I'm putting my glove on, that's been really helping me be kind of slow things down, take a deep breath, look at the situation, and passing that on. And I'm passing it on to other people that way. And those are some of the keys that I've been passing. Like, I mean, slow down, don't run. Let's do this. Let's keep our one glove off, because you have to stop and put that glove on before you go inside. And if you start doing that, and of course it's a training thing and repetition, but I've started to notice a lot of the senior the senior firefighters that are there, the younger captains starting to do that now, keeping one glove off or both gloves off, and they have to slow down for a second and look at the whole situation while they put their gloves on. So those are some of the things that we've been doing in the firehouse, some of the things that I've been personally doing to slow things down, to kind of paying attention to that situation awareness. Help me with that, because I did notice after one of your, like I said, after one of your lectures, I was writing some notes down and looked, and I was like, holy crap, I do that. I do exactly what he said. Yeah. I know I do.
I appreciate that, man. That's something that I definitely had to pick up on too throughout my time was, you know, I worked and volunteered in companies where we were off to the races. And I absolutely think there's a time and a place to run. Like, I'm okay with that. It can't be hasty. It can't be inaccurate. You need to maintain your accuracy and make sure you have the capability to take in all the information with the speed. But man, there's some calls where, yeah, you slow it down. Just those couple seconds, man, our minds work so fast that yeah. You can really get in a lot of information in a little bit of time. So I like that. I'm forcing myself not to put one glove on, and that bought me time to take in more information. That's pretty cool.
And I still fail at that every day, because it's just habit sometimes to put both gloves on.
Sure.
And I'll find myself, I have to stop as soon as I get out the ladder truck. And even getting out of the ladder truck, we were talking about one of the guys was learning to ride up, and he was like, well, how do you, like, what are your steps getting out of the ladder truck? So we talked about it. You know, I have on my left hand side on the dog box, I've got my flashlight and my camera right there. It's not attached to myself, and my air pack's on. Obviously, I'll put my straps on. But what I'll do is, after I hit the MDT and we mark on the scene and I'm sizing things up, I take a minute, I grab my gloves now, put my left glove on, and then I pull everything down in front of me, and I don't look at the building. I get my stuff squared away. I put my waist strap on. I adjust my pack to make sure it's right. My helmet goes on. I put my left glove on. I now have my flashlight on, my camera on my right side. My right hand's open. My left hand's holding my right glove. And then I come around to the front of the fire truck, and I look at the scene. And that even slows me down even more. But talking to him about that, he's like, well, I never really thought about that. And I was like, this just gives you a second to kind of catch your breath. You kind of block out everything else that's going on with you as you turn your radio on and get everything ready. You're not looking at the scene. You're literally looking at the floor your feet were sitting on in the apparatus. And then you take that step back and look around the front of the fire truck, and you're like, oh, here we go. And then you take that one more, you know, that one more stop to put your glove on. And now you've kind of slowed your heart rate down, your breathing down, and your mind down a little bit to kind of take in as much information. And that's helped. That helped him. He started, I watched him the other day. He had a call and he started doing that. Not as smoothly, but he's good. He's working on it that way. But that's been helpful as well.
No, I appreciate, like, you taking the time to catch opportunities to build tempo. I know Chief Riley and I just talked about this the other day, and actually one of the first training days that I spoke at with, when Gabe and Jimmy was there, he talked about that, like, building tempo on the fire ground is, yes, it's training, but it's finding the little things that you can improve upon within the scene. Like, okay, well, why did you have trouble getting the salt to the roof or operating the salt? Well, it's because these back end things happened. I missed steps 20 steps ago. You know, 30 seconds into the incident. All right, well, let's dig in on that small thing. So you're identifying processes, just getting off the fire apparatus. And so many people, I think, can easily overlook that, but you're identifying the processes, which is going to affect the outcome. And you're leaning in on those small things. And that makes such a huge difference, I think, on the back end. And if you employ that same strategy, then you can start to, like, overlay that on bigger things. Like, now you're deep in a building, what affected you? Was it the thing you missed because your process was messed up, just stepping foot off the rig and you were all shuffled? And, like, what you're doing is you're making sure that everything is right and together. So that way, when you look up, okay, I know all my gears buttoned up. Now I can take in all the information without feeling rushed. And if something's out of place and something's wrong, I can identify that immediately. I don't think we do that enough.
I agree. And it's being passed on, like even my Tillerman, as he's been training with me, he's even slowed down coming off the ladder truck. And now, but when it's just riding three of us on the ladder truck, which is, it's, we do normally every, you know, most of the days there's three of us, I can look down the side of the ladder truck and see him, and we could do an eye to eye watch, and he could watch me keep my pace, and I could watch him keep his pace. But we've built that system out to where we're not missing too many things. We could kind of work better as a team that way. It's kind of it's been helpful, and then helping people do that. That's been the tough part, because everything's built on tempo, especially in our firehouse. You know, we have two engines, a ladder and a medic that run out of there. We're a pretty busy station in general, and the engines are pretty competitive with each other. But yeah. what we've seen is like the slowest, smoothest, fast type thing. Those guys are the ones that are being rock stars versus the ones getting out of the gate faster. But it's a double-edged sword either way for them. So,
oh yeah, for sure. I feel like a broken record with this. And I even tell my kids this when it comes to like basketball or whatever sport they're in. Like it feels like you're slowing down, but if you take just a couple extra seconds to build up whatever it is that you're trying to do, like set up shots or make sure your gear is squared away, taking a little bit more information, you will make up time in the back end and you will be faster overall. If you rush, you miss things, then you got to back up and punt. Like those couple second investments in the front, I know it feels slow. I guarantee you though, you're going to make up time on the back end.
Yeah, try to tell the 10-year-old that while he's playing baseball.
Yeah. Right, Alex, I was going to use another one because you're a parent, right? Do you have kids?
Yeah, two boys, 9 and 7. Hudson's actually getting ready to turn 10 in 2 weeks. So big double digits. Watch out.
Congrats. Yeah, we're right around the corner from you. My two daughters, they'll be 12 and 9 this summer. We're at the age where I absolutely feel like if I tell them something and it doesn't get done right, I just want to do it. And I keep having to remind myself like, no, wait, hold on. We're building skills and repetitions. It could be something simple as like the way they clean like the dishes from dinner or whatever, yeah. Like how small and dumb it is. Like, no. I'm going to call them back 14 times if I have to, like, all right, here's another thing we missed. And I catch myself in the way I explain it, but I almost take some similar strategy sometimes, whether I'm teaching recruits in school or whatever the things I'm doing on the firehouse floor. And it's not an admonishment of anybody. It's just, I'm giving more opportunity to like, no, we're going to get our hands on this and we're going to keep doing it until it's right. And I know sometimes it frustrates people, especially the people that have more time in it, have kept their skill set up, but that's where we get to rally around other people. And that was one of those, I don't know if I call it a leadership lesson, but one of those things I took just from parenting that helped with just teaching my people. And sometimes it's not even my way. I got this from one of my favorite officers I worked with. He's like, hey, listen, I'm just going to throw something at you. You're about to do this. Just consider what is about to happen, because I've seen this happen. Now that I've given you that information, I'm going to step back and you do whatever it is you want to do. And sometimes you see the wheels turn, like, okay, yeah, he's right. I'm not going to do that. Or like, now we're going to force it. And maybe they do find something else better that I didn't even consider. But it's just that back and forth where you just got a lot of people experience things, man.
And that's you could see that trying to help instruct new instructors. Like, hey, like they'll come up and ask questions. And some of the times you're just like literally holding them back with an arm, like, just give them a second. Let them figure this out the best they can. There's two paths they're going to take. They're either going to be a rock star with it, or they're really going to screw it up. And let them figure it out. Then walk over and say, so what could we have done different? How could this been done different? Is there anything we could have done different for a different outcome? And let them kind of develop that thinking pattern. And it's hard to do to a new instructor, like, but they're doing it wrong. Like, they don't think they are. Let's see what happens to them for a second. And then go tell them. Now, obviously, if it's a safety issue, you want to stop it immediately. But something as simple as throwing a ladder, it's like scooting along a sidewalk or something like that. Like, give them a second to figure it out on their own. And then if they can't figure it out on their own, stop them. Or let them follow through and be like, hey, how could we have done it different? Or have you thought about trying it this way? And that's one of the things. And like you, I feel I've become a better instructor that way by having kids. Yeah, I knew that. I'd had kids like, well, a long time ago, not in my late 30s, early 40s, I would have kids, right? So,
right. So one of the things that I've really appreciated, and like this is the way that we've met through the conferences, and I consider myself so fortunate to have met like you and a lot of the other people that we've, you know, had the opportunity to rub elbows with, but you go out to, we met in Alexandria, or when you're out in Wichita or Florida, like those hotel lobby beers, man, or wherever you're at in the evenings, whatever the social events are, is where, I mean, the course material is fantastic, but then the way you get to pick up other people's brains, or just kind of reignite some passion, I feel like, you get those little points where like, all right, I'm kind of trudging through, and then you get around like-minded people and you're like, all right, I'm on fire again. Like how, yeah. I mean, I know you've seen that traveling around. Like how does that speak to you? Does that get you going? What have you learned?
That's where I feel that those hotel lobby beers or lobby beers in general, or just being out at the bar with the, at the socials that people have, the organizations have set up, I feel that you learn the same, if not more, there than you do in class, because everybody's so in your class or whatever, everybody's so mission focused on that goal, to whatever your goal is for the day, to make it to lunch, to make it to the end of the day at 4:30, whatever it is. But when everybody's kind of doing downtime and at dinner and enjoying that round at the bar or whatever, that's when the real person, the real firefighter comes out. And that's when you hear real stories and you learn small things. Like the amount of people that I've been able to meet just doing that alone is amazing. And as fortunate as I am and lucky as I am to be able to say that, I've met you, we've been able to sit down and have conversations, and all the people we've met through training days and all the people we've got to experience and have beers with throughout the country and up and down the East Coast has been amazing. But finding out who they are and where they come from and what makes them tick a little bit, that's what happens in those lobby beers. And you find out the real story, and keep asking questions. And sometimes just tell you to, all right, we're done talking about it or whatever, but you keep asking questions. But that's where you find, that's where you pick up that little bit of knowledge, like building construction or why things are done a certain way at a certain department, or why they do things a certain way on the West Coast versus the East Coast. And when you look at it, how old the fire service is on one side of the country versus how it is on the other side of the country. It's kind of crazy. And not even that, but even in the state alone, like in Virginia, we go from rural coal mines down in Southwest Virginia to the Tidewater, which is the largest independent city in Virginia. Things are done completely different. Like not even night and day, it's like seasons, like fall and summer different.
Wow.
Which is crazy. So, and you find that out just sitting around talking and being open-minded and allowing people to just say what they want to say. And that's kind of the cool thing about it, and those were the nuggets that you pick up. I have a list on my phone that I write things down, like, oh, I got to remember that. I got to look this up or whatever, find things up, because I want to know more about it. I can't remember. We were talking to somebody and they were like from Colorado or somewhere out that way. They had a certain type of hook. And I came, have you ever heard? They were calling. I was like, what are you talking about, man? He goes, this. I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. He goes, oh yeah, it looks like this. And he brought a picture. I was like, yeah, I've never seen that. He goes, really? All our fire trucks carry this. You should try it. I'm like, oh, absolutely. I'd love to try it. Like some type of hook or something for pulling lath and plaster a little easier in their area. And they have this hook that works miraculously. Like this is all we carry. I'm like, that's cool. I've never seen one before. So
was that Nate Jameson by chance? Or he was from Colorado a couple of years back when he did a presentation.
It may have been. I can't remember what it was, but we were talking about something and I can't even remember the name of it. I have to go back and through my notes and look for it, but I can't remember the name of the hook it was, but it was out that way somewhere. It may have been him. Now as you said it, but he was like, I was like, God, I don't know what you're talking about, dude. I really have no clue. Like zero. I thought I had a grasp on everything. I mean, I've got a library of stuff over there on the wall of like tools and history and fire trucks and firehouses and leadership and all sorts. He brought this up. I'm like, yeah, that one's new. That was
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that. And it really broadened my perspective hearing him talk about just the firefighting culture in Colorado. Cause he was doing the same thing. He's like, do you know what a miner is? And everybody started laughing. He's like, no, like there was a tool based around the Colorado miners digging for gold and whatever else. And they were using vernacular from like the gold rush days. And that stuck with how they name certain tools and have certain positions on the trucks. And I was like, wasn't even on my radar. I just thought it was a cool way to like bring in very local culture into what they were doing And like, it's just what they did. And it was so foreign to so many other people here being on the East Coast. It was just a really well packaged deal. And it reminded me of that. Just, they could have a tool that we would never consider using. And that's their bread and butter every day. And that's where the whole fire cutting and this local bit comes in.
Yeah, that's what's cool. That's one of the cool things about the fire service is as big as it is, it's still small enough to have small things like that in your region to be like, that's new. Right. That's the neat part about it.
All right. So you got somebody just coming onto the shift. You're on your way out. You know, you got 30 plus years in this joint. You grab them by the shoulders and you're shaking them. You're like Billy Madison, right? And you're like, stay here as long as you can. But like, if you can give them that one nugget of, I've got my foot out the door, I'm leaving, you're just coming in, I have one thing to tell you, this is what I want to tell you. What do you got?
Ask questions. Don't ever stop asking questions for everything. Both administratively, tactically, whatever it may be, ask questions. I wish I would ask more questions. I wish I would have asked more questions back then, just to have it down. And when you get the answer, write the answer down, because that's gold. That's the stuff that I wish that, you know, I wish that I could still get back. Like, several guys have passed away when I started volunteering, way back when, that I'd love to go back and have conversations with, but I can't. You know, just those little nuggets, but ask questions. That's what I tell the new guy coming in, because that's not only do you get information about the fire service, but you get to meet people, you know?
Yes.
I mean, the simple, that's one of the things I think we've taken for granted in the fire service, is just the human aspect of it. Is just going up and talking to people, and just asking, you know, about their department, about the situation they were in, about whatever it may be that you want to know more about. And people tell you, if they're uncomfortable talking about it, they'll say, hey, I'm not good right now to talk about that, but here's my information. You know, I'd love to talk about it sometime, but not right now. But yeah, that's one of the things, you know, talking to people is one of the cool things about our job.
No, it's awesome, man. And that's kind of what got us here. So between training days and all the other people that we've rubbed elbows with, from like Dave and Chris and Lex and so many other people that, you know, we've had the opportunity to rub elbows with, and then Todd, Mike, like, there's so many good dudes that, you know, I've been able to learn so much from, and it's kind of what, you know, got us here today. So, man, I sincerely appreciate it. And we've been humming at about an hour now. Is there anything you want to finish up on? Like, I know you got plenty of gold nuggets out there.
I hope I did. I hope I appreciate the opportunity. I take every opportunity that I have like this as a gift. And not take advantage of it, but this has been fun. You know, just like you mentioned, being able to talk to you and be able to contact you, and just on a whim, just to either shoot the shit or ask a question about, it's been fabulous. And as big as the fire service is, it's still kind of small with everybody that we know, and everybody that you get to meet, like, oh yeah, I know that guy. You're like, how do you know him? Like, we did this. this is like the 6 degrees of separation with us was that guy, Kevin Bacon. Right.
Yeah. Right. Right.
Same type of thing. Now that's the game you got to play. But I think the new game is 6 degrees of separation with Dave LeBlanc. That's the new one. You do.
Yeah. Right. He's always like ground zero for so many things, isn't he?
Right. But no, I'm just, you know, just if I were to leave anything, it's just be every day, just get better at the fire services, because it's an open book. The more you ask, the more you find out, the better off you're going to be in the long run.
Yeah. So. Hell yeah, man. Well, it's as good as place as any to wrap this up, dude. I appreciate you. Thank you for taking your time out for me and putting out the good word. Like, it's always a pleasure talking to you, man.